Welcome to Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. I'm your host, Tim Friedman. Season 3, Episode 4, and back from special assignment is rock and roll expert, fellow Clevelander, longtime friend, Frank Ost. Frank, welcome back.
It's great to be with you again.
Dion DiMucci shortened it to just Dion, and Lou Reed introduced Dion back in 1989, our Hall of Fame inductees. What did you think of Dion DiMucci?
Blue-eyed soul. Guess he was from the Bronx, which actually made him Lou Reed's hero, which is unusual. You think of Lou Reed, you think of somebody who talks through the songs, but he was really Lou's hero, and I think that Lou actually inducted him, if I remember correctly.
He did. Can you imagine Lou Reed singing doo-wop music?
No, I can't. Nobody could, and that's why it's so unusual.
How about Lou Reed singing Abraham, Martin, and John?
No, definitely not.
It reignited Dion's career, didn't it,
yes,
in 1968? That was written by a fellow named Dick Holler, who also wrote the song Snoopy versus the Red Baron a couple of years earlier. That's neat, and it's
very weird
how that rock and roll works. Otis Redding played his last show ever on the big TV show here, Upbeat, Channel 5 in Cleveland. That was his final performance. He died in that plane crash the very next day in December 1967. Otis Redding was inducted by Little Richard.
What a terrible loss for music. I mean, he had so much to give. Of course, he had that posthumous number one with Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. But if that's all you've heard of him, he was an electrifying performer.
Only 27 at the time of his death.
The dreaded 27. Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Brian Jones.
Jeez.
And now Amy Winehouse. Amy Winehouse.
And you have three no-brainers, the Rolling Stones, the Temptations, and Stevie Wonder.
What more can be said about any of the three of them? You'll get no argument from me about these five. Tremendous class, obviously. It was one of their first class, so they had a lot to choose from, and these are five perfect choices.
Concert calendar time, Frank. It's good to talk about concerts, isn't it?
It is, definitely.
Not a lot coming up in Cleveland or the Cleveland area in July, but a lot of shows have been announced. Lots of folks back on tour. Elton John's returning to the stage in Germany in September. You know, he's got tickets on sale for that Progressive Field show.
That's right.
A year from now, July 30th. Foreigner's back on stage, Chicago, the Styx band is coming back, you know, without Dennis DeYoung,
mm-hmm.
ZZ Top, and Wilson is going to be performing in selected cities beginning this month.
Very nice.
Springsteen on Broadway, we talked about that. He's at a different venue now on Broadway, the St. James Theater, if you saw him in the past, was at a different place. Many, many more, but on July 31st at Blossom, show I'll be going to with my lovely bride, James Taylor, and special guest Jackson Brown, Blossom Music Center. Should be a good show.
Should be a very good show.
Saturday night.
Yeah, those are two great entertainers.
REO Speedwagon's going to ramp it up. They'll be playing a couple of shows in Florida. Santana's going to be at the House of Blues for 8 shows in September, November, and December. They're going to do like a residency at the House of Blues, not here. In Cleveland, but in Las Vegas. And just announced, Rod Stewart will also be doing a little residency at the Coliseum at Caesars, you know, where Celine Dion and Elton John used to perform.
Sure.
From October 6th to the 23rd, Rod Stewart will be at Caesar's Palace. So that should be good. August, your favorite band is coming. Air Supply. They'll be at Youngstown Palace Theater. Gordon Lightfoot, the night before, will be at the very same venue. Billy Joel's going to play Fenway Park a couple of days from now in August on the 4th, on a Wednesday night, in fact.
Okay.
Donnie Iris and the Cruisers will be at Kent Stage. That should be a good show.
Definitely.
And something that was also announced like last month, the Happy Together Tour.
Oh, yes.
That
definitely means
you know, all your favorites, Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, the Turtles, the Classics 4, the Vogues, the Cowsills.
Can't do without the Cowsills.
And the Association.
Yeah.
So that'll be at the Goodyear Theater in Akron. Hall & Oates, by the way, were scheduled for August 17th at Blossom. That show was canceled, so hopefully they'll be rescheduling that very soon. One-hit wonder time, Frankie, Peppermint Rainbow. It sounds like anything from Mamas and Papas or a follow-up hit from the Spanky and Our Gang, Will You Be Staying After Sunday?
Yeah, classic tune. Like you said, if I didn't know, I'd say it was the Mamas and Papas. Yeah,
especially staying after Sunday would have been followed up by Monday.
Exactly. Would have made sense.
The American pop group, the Peppermint Rainbow, was from Baltimore, Maryland, featuring vocalists sisters Bonnie and Patty Lambden. They were discovered, and the song was produced by a fellow named Paul Leka, the same guy who wrote and co-produced the hit Na 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 Hey Hey Hey.
Oh, really?
He sang the song from Steam.
Steam, yes.
And Green Tambourine co-wrote that with the Lemon Pipers, which, by the way, was recorded right here in Cleveland at Cleveland Recording Studios. Did you know that Paul Leka was also the co-producer of the first two REO Speedwagon albums?
Really? All right. I didn't know that either.
The follow-up by the Peppermint Rainbow was Don't Wake Me Up in the Morning, Michael. Remember that one?
No. I don't think anybody else does either. Michael didn't wake them.
It did spend 9 weeks on the Billboard Hot 100, never cracking the top 40, though reaching only number 54. So that was the one and only time we heard from the Peppermint Rainbow.
Exactly.
Not rainbows, but rainbow. Amboy Dukes, Journey to the Center of the Mind, you know, Ted Nugent.
Yep, this is the one they drag out of the oldies bin every time they want to play something from Ted Nugent that's a little bit older. This was obviously his first group.
Yep, he dropped the Amboy Dukes after a while, the only original member to stay with the band through the 70s, and in 1975 signed with Epic Records to begin his solo career.
That's right.
Cat Scratch Fever.
Really took off from there, yeah.
Hit number 16 in the summer of 1968. Brand new category, segment Frankie. This was one you came up with because we've been talking about great album covers. You know, Colin Elgee I've spoken about before. He did a lot of work with Zeppelin. He also did work for Pink Floyd, The Hollies, Genesis, Trick of the Tail. Colin also did The Year of the Cat. Mm-hmm. So guys like that specialized in album jackets, album covers, the inner sleeve, the liner notes. So you came up with a great idea. And I'm going to ask you what your two best album covers were from 1968, as we go in order, to kind of track how things were,
right,
which gave you a lot of information about the artist, did they not? First one?
Well, going along with my choice from 1967, which is Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, I came up with the exact opposite of that. We're Only in It for the Money by Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention.
Good choice.
They parodied the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band photo shoot, in which he stated everything was a direct negative. So in other words, if it was a sunny day on the Sgt. Pepper's, it would be a
cloudy day,
a rainstorm. we had a thunderstorm on ours. The only person that was actually on the album was Jimi Hendrix, who took the place of Sonny Liston, who was on the Sgt. Pepper's album. But Jimi Hendrix was actually there at the photo shoot.
Wow.
One of his friends. At that point, they had the whole thing set up, and they were going to put it on their album covers. And of course, their record company said, we don't know if we can get away with this, Frank, because, you know, we've got, well, Frank phoned Paul McCartney seeking permission to do the parody, and McCartney told them that that was an issue for the business managers. Zappa responded that, hey, they're the artists, they should be telling the business managers what for, which was okay, but I think what he didn't realize is that he wasn't talking about the Mothers of Invention. He was talking about the Beatles. The Beatles were a corporation by that time, and there was no way that Paul McCartney could say, go ahead and do it without checking with a million people. So basically, Capitol Records, as you might figure, they objected to the whole situation, and the album was not released for 5 months, at which point, you know, Frank was getting a little bit upset with the whole situation. He finally said, okay, we'll switch them around. We'll do the inside gatefold will be the Sgt. Pepper's parody, and then they'll have a picture of us on the outside. And that's what it ended up being, and that's how they got away with it.
So it's a parody, the album of the hippie subculture, left and right-wing politics.
Yes, absolutely.
And Sgt. Pepper's.
And boy, was I don't know if Frank's ever gotten over that. He said he was angered over the decision. He said it would have been much more effective if they'd had their original cover on there. But what can you say?
Think Paul was passing the buck on that one?
I'm sure he was. But again, like I said, the Beatles were more of a corporation. They weren't a small little group from Liverpool anymore. They were part of Capitol Records and later to be Apple. And a lot of hands had their A lot of people had their hands in this, let's put it that way.
Were they label mates, Zappa and the Beatles?
No. I don't believe so. I think it was, Verve was the record company that was putting out the Zappa album. So they weren't on the same label, which probably didn't help things at all.
Right. Now you have an interesting one by Big Brother and the Holding Company. That's Janis Joplin's group. Cheap Thrills.
Yeah. Now this one, in fact, I did have this, and I actually used to look at it and read it as they played the songs on the album. The cover was done by underground cartoonist Robert Crumb after the band's original idea of having a cover with them photo in a bed naked together was thrown out by Columbia Records. Crumb had done a bunch of comic book slides, I guess you would say.
He's in the Comic Book Hall of Fame.
Right, exactly. And he came up with this idea, and Janis Joplin just absolutely loved it. So what you have is different cells for each song with who was the lead singer, lead guitar player, all that stuff. All that was mentioned. And each song had its own cartoon. And as a sign of the time, and I love this, there is a label in the bottom right-hand corner of it, Frisco Hell's Angels approved. Now, isn't that something from 68?
Sure. Peace of My Heart is on there.
Absolutely. Turned out to be number 9 on Rolling Stone's list of 100 greatest album covers of all time.
That's amazing.
Crumb refused to take any money for his artwork. However, later he did authorize the sale of prints of the cover, some of which he signed before sale. Kind of a neat thing, neat story.
He was an artist for American Greetings here in Cleveland for quite some time, too. Robert Crumb.
Exactly. So fun to read about that and kind of go back and remember that album. And then I remember laying on my bed with the reading the comics.
We're tracking, Frankie, the number one albums and the top 10 singles from each year as we move forward into 1982, just to get a feel for the evolution of music. So 1968, from January to December, it started out with a Magical Mystery Tour. White Album was later on, that was toward the end of the year, but Magical Mystery Tour by the Beatles started out the year in top spot. It was taken over by Paul Moriarty and the Bloomin' Hits. Remember Love is Blue?
Oh, do I ever.
Number one in the
instrumental,
spring.
Yes.
Simon and Garfunkel then, the Graduate soundtrack, Bookends, Back to the Graduate, Back to the Bookends. So that's how 68 was going for a while. And then Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, the Beat of the Brass.
Exactly. And they were big back then. Fun group to listen to, had a lot of hits, songs like Casino Royale and, Taste of Honey, a lot of good hits.
Just like Wixie, how they would go from Herb Alpert to Cream. We went from Herb Alpert and his Tijuana Brass to Cream and Wheels of Fire, which would spend 3 weeks at the top of the charts that year.
That's right.
The Rascals, not a lot of greatest hits packages topped the charts or even were being released back then. There was no oldie stations.
Yeah, there was not that many with much of a war chest, let's put it that way, to release.
Exactly. Timepiece, Greatest Hits by the Rascals. The Doors, Waiting for the Sun. Cheap Thrills spent 5 weeks at the top of the charts.
There we go, yes.
I wonder how the gatefold and the album cover itself led to it being such a popular album to buy.
Well, it probably stuck out. If you go into a record store and you see something like that, you're bound to pick it up.
Not to mention the great tunes that were on there. Jimi Hendrix, Electric Ladyland.
Fantastic record.
Good stuff. Now, you go from Herb Alpert and even Simon and Garfunkel to Hendrix and Big Brother and The Doors, then back to Glen Campbell with Wichita Lineman.
Isn't that funny? Jimi Hendrix to Glen Campbell. And yet, in their own way, both were great guitar players. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Then it rounded out the year with the Beatles and the White Album. I wonder if that will be one of your best album covers when we talk about 1969 next time around. It would stay there, the White Album did, until early part of February 69. It would take turns at number one with Wichita Lineman until springtime of 69.
Yeah. One of the things about the Beatles, and we kind of alluded to this before when we talked about 67 in the charts, but I did a little bit of scoping back. And when Magical Mystery Tour finally fell off the charts, number one of the charts, on February 24th, 1968, for the previous 77 weeks, 66 of them had been either number one records by the Monkees or the Beatles.
That's incredible.
So think about that.
Yeah.
I think there were four albums by the Monkees that were number one during that time, and three by the Beatles. And so, I mean, I live for statistics like that.
Yeah.
Just shows you where the world was then. It was, boy, it was a Monkees and Beatles world, wasn't it?
It sure was. Now, the top 10 singles, 1968. I'm not going to give away the Beatles as number one, but maybe I will. Hey Jude was number one. which you can imagine. Number 10, Tighten Up by Archie Bell and the Drells.
Yeah, good. I remember tune. That.
Mrs. Robinson, Simon and Garfunkel, makes sense. Hugo Montenegro, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. This Guy's in Love with You, one and only time Herb Alpert sang. It was a pretty good tune.
That's right. And as I remember, that was kind of one of the last of the Tijuana Brass hits. Maybe because he sang, or maybe because he was starting to get very involved with A&M Records.
Yeah, the record label. You can get that going. Cream was number six with Sunshine of Your Love. I've heard that before.
Definitely.
Young Rascals, People Gotta Be Free, number five. Number four, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. That was after Otis Redding's tragic death in December of 67. Honey by Bobby Goldsboro was number three.
Yeah, kind of one of the most mocked records of all time, I think. And dutifully so, because it's pretty tough record to listen
to
nowadays.
It's sappy, it's sad, there's nothing happy about that song. Kind of like Gene the next year, which, if you can imagine, was even slower than Honey.
Yeah, and I just remember that Bobby Goldsboro was on every variety show, and that was the mainstay of TV back in the 60s.
With the big guitar and the big hair. And
if there was a variety show, Dean Martin, Bob Hope, whatever, he was on there.
Did he have his own variety show?
I think he might have.
He may not have needed one.
he may not have.
Love is Blue was number two. That was out in the spring and number one that year, in the spring of 68, just before the Bobby Kennedy assassination. Coinciding with Martin Luther King's assassination.
Right.
I don't know what that has to do with anything, but Love is Blue was just such a surprise hit.
Yeah.
But I like it.
It's a nice melody. It's one of those things kind of like what Theme from a Summer Place was another one that just kind of...
Percy Faith.
You turn it on, you're in the car, you know, it's 2 or 3 minutes and it's done. It's a fun song.
The Beatles, number one, Hey Jude.
Well, probably my favorite Beatles song, if I have to be honest about it. And, covered by so many different artists, both in pop and jazz.
Yeah.
What a fantastic song.
Not to mention in the movie Yesterday.
Yep.
If you've seen that one, they wanted to call it Hey Dude.
Absolutely.
It's a fun movie. July 19th, today in rock history, my brother Bob and sister-in-law Rosie were married on that date in 1969. Talk about something big that happened that weekend. My brother was married Saturday. They landed on the moon the next day. Friday was Chappaquiddick.
Wow, that's incredible.
So a lot happened that weekend, and I'm sure.
And oh, by the way, your brother got married.
Yeah, what a weekend that was.
That was incredible, and that's the way it was at that time. And just think, the next month there was a little thing called Woodstock.
Yeah.
I mean, just incredible.
And the Manson murders.
That's right.
Just a couple weeks earlier than the Walk on the Moon and Chappaquiddick was the gigantic, tragic 4th of July storm we had in Cleveland. Here
in the Cleveland, greater Cleveland area. Yeah.
Something was happening every weekend or every other weekend that summer.
It was some kind of year.
1954, July 19th, Elvis Presley and Sun Records released his first single, That's All Right, and the B-side was Blue Moon of Kentucky.
Wow.
Which, if you've seen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles toward the end, they sing that song.
That's
right.
In
the beat-up car. 1966, 50-year-old Frank Sinatra married a 20-year-old Mia Farrow.
Yeah, that was scandalous at the time, I remember.
A couple of groups broke up on this date. In 1969, Spencer Davis Group broke up, and then in 1976, Deep Purple announced their split.
Yeah, and they would come back together again and split a number of times in the future.
Birthdays, Vicky Carr. It must be him. Is that him? It must be him. Remember that song from 1967?
Yeah.
She was born in 1941. Brian May of Queen, 1947.
Wow, fantastic guitar player.
Bernie Leadon, of the Eagles, 1947. And Keith Gaccio of Grateful Dead was born in 1948. Bright Frankie, featured artist this time around, and this goes together with a brand new segment which we'll bring back from time to time. It's called Bands We Wish We Heard More From. Sometimes we know why, because they got sick of each other. Maybe they wanted to join another band, leave the band and be a solo artist, or maybe we just don't know why they broke up or stopped putting out music. But this kind of happened with Three Dog Night. Bands We Wish We Heard More From, the American rock band from L.A., formed in 1967, had a really nice nine-year career.
Yeah.
And then it was over.
A lot of people nowadays, probably that are listening to this, don't remember Three Dog Night. But let me tell you, they were one of the hottest bands in the land in the late 60s and early 70s, definitely.
Danny Hutton, Corey Wells, Chuck Negron, quickly added Jimmy Greenspoon on keyboards, Joe Shermy on bass, Floyd Sneed was the drummer, Michael Alsop, guitar. A lot of those guys stuck with them for a long, long time with reunion tours and whatnot. Chuck and Corey switched off on lead vocals, which was kind of cool. I really like when they're able to switch off. Don't quite know who's singing, kind of like Chicago.
Exactly.
Or the Beatles. Dunhill Records was their home. ABC and Dunhill, you know, they kind of were sister recording labels. And the other acts on the Dunhill roster were Jim Croce, Jimmy Buffett, Barry McGuire, The Grassroots, Mamas and Papas, and Hamilton, Joe Frank, and Reynolds.
Okay.
That's
so they had
some.
They had a few hit makers in there, sure.
12 gold albums. 21 top 40 hits between 69 and 75. Three number
That's
ones.
That's just incredible.
Yeah, Joy to the
21.
World.
21.
21. They're all great tunes, too. Mama Told Me Not to Come, Black and White, bunch of other top 10 hits like Old Fashioned Love Song, which hit number 4 in 1971. They originally intended that for Karen Carpenter.
Really?
Richard turned it down. They had just done Rainy Days and Mondays, and, We've Only Just Begun. The song was written by Paul Williams, who did a lot of writing for other artists, and especially for Three Dog Night. But he wrote Rainy Days and We've Only Just Begun. And the Paul Williams version was performed by him on The Muppet Show in the mid-70s.
Oh, my
God. And also a portion of it on an episode of The Odd Couple by Paul Williams, who was a favorite of mine on the show Love Boat or Fantasy
Island. Oh, that's
Island,
right.
Later
I remember
on in the 70s.
Sure.
He also wrote for Three Dog Night, The Family of Man, and one of my favorites, if not my favorites of theirs, Out in the Country.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Other great songwriters. We talked about how the Monkees, the Jackson 5, would have folks write for them. And they picked the right songwriters, too, didn't they? Besides Paul Williams, Russ Ballard of Argent wrote New York Groove.
That's right.
By Ace Frehley.
Ace Frehley, yeah.
Santana's Winning. And America's comeback song, You Can Do Magic. So he wrote for them. Hoyt Axton, the country folk singer, wrote Joy to the World, Never Been to Spain. And the top five hit for Ringo Starr, The No-No Song.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Joy to the World, you can't get much bigger than that was. I think it was number one for the year, if I remember
71.
Correctly.
Yeah. That was a good year for music, too. You had Isaac Hayes and so many great tunes. Randy Newman wrote Mama Told Me Not to Come for Eric Burdon's first solo album in 1966. So that was a big hit for them, number one for Three Dog Night. Alan Gordon wrote Celebrate. And he also wrote a couple of hits for the Turtles, She'd Rather Be With Me and Happy Together.
Really?
And Alan Gordon also had a comeback hit for Barbara Streisand. She wasn't coming back. She was as big as any star then, but he kind of made a comeback with My Heart Belongs to Me in 1977. So he wrote all those tunes.
Fantastic.
They picked a good roster of songwriters, didn't they?
Oh, they sure did. I don't know whether by accident they just fell into them or if it was a plot, whether, their record company was helping them. I'm not sure how that quite works.
Maybe they saw the success other bands like the Monkees were having, and they picked the right songwriters, and they can have some big hits.
Well, I think it's important if you're pretty sure that you can't write songs, it behooves you not to try to write songs and put out bad stuff. I mean, if you can find some great stuff, I think it works out great.
So we've already listed five or six great songwriters, and here's another one. Harry Nilsson wrote One.
That's right.
Is the loneliest number.
Mm-hmm.
Galt McDermott. You may not remember him, but you know his songs, Good Morning Starshine, the big hit by Oliver, and Aquarius, Let the Sunshine In, which was a number two hit for the year. by the Fifth Dimension.
Everybody was looking at that Hair album, weren't they?
They were. And Gold also wrote the song Easy to Be Hard, which was also part of the Hair soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
David Arkin co-wrote Black and White. You may know David Arkin, his son Alan Arkin.
Oh, really?
Well, David was blackballed from Hollywood during the McCarthy era, you know, for his leftist views. But Black and White was written by Arkin and Earl Robinson in 1954 to celebrate the landmark Supreme Court decision in the Brown versus Board of Education case.
Okay, so that was quite a bit earlier that he wrote that song.
Yeah, and came back a little less than 20 years later to be a number one hit by Three Dog Night. Not the Temptations
That's
or Stevie
right.
Wonder, but Three Dog Night.
The ink is black, the page is white.
Kind of like ebony and ivory.
That's right.
David Loggins, you've heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
Please Come to Boston. Then later on, Nobody Loves Me Like You Do, wrote my second favorite song, if not my all-time favorite of theirs, Pieces of April from the fall of 72.
Okay, yeah.
Great tunes. Wrote a lot of country hits, and most notably, perhaps, David Loggins wrote the theme music, which is still being played today for the Masters Golf Tournament.
Oh, okay. Is that piano little thing?
Yeah.
The interlude? Yeah.
Hello, friends.
Absolutely.
Daniel Moore, Shambhala, and a song that Three Dog Night recorded in 1973 and released, but did better for B.W. Stevenson, called My Maria.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So that runs down all the big hits they had and their songwriters. And you're right. They chose the right songwriters.
They sure did.
And they knew how to do that. So Liar, Never Been to Spain, One, Easy to Be Hard, Shambhala, Pieces of April, Celebrate, Out in the Country, Family of Man, Let Me Serenade You, The Show Must Go On in 1974. Sure as I'm sitting here, hit number 16 that year, and then it was over.
That was it. And when they stopped, they stopped. There was nothing.
They had some internal strife. Joe Shermy left the band in early 1973. Danny Hutton's drug use was so bad that he needed assistance of a registered nurse.
Oh, my God.
Just so he could keep touring.
Tells you something right there.
Yeah, he developed a bad case of jaundice. He began to skip recording sessions and only want to record, you know, a couple of songs when he was there, kind of lost interest. So they kicked him out of the group in 1975. Chuck Negron had his own issues with drugs, which a lot of times that happens with the band.
Sounds like too much success. Yeah,
too much.
Yeah.
By 1975, the hits stopped coming. The album Coming Down Your Way didn't do well. ABC Records then was in charge of their recording future. And then they got taken over by MCA Records, and with the dawn of the disco era, that really spelled the end of Three Dog Night.
Yeah, it sounds like they were kind of shuffled between a couple of record companies, and they didn't have the kind of
oomph, popularity, cachet.
Exactly.
And that was the dawn of the disco era, too. 1975 brought like the TK Records and Casey and the Sunshine Band. And Columbia was doing so well with their disco artists like Johnny Taylor and whatever.
And I wonder if at some point, the singer-songwriter era had really taken over. And a lot of these people were now putting out their own songs rather than letting other people. Now these guys were doing it on their own, with Jim Croce and
Elton John, Bernie Taupin.
Absolutely.
Gordon Lightfoot was always doing stuff.
Sure. James Taylor.
Yeah, people
were
writing their own stuff.
And instead of those going out on the market and looking for somebody to record them, they were recording themselves.
And by 1975, Three Dog Night, it kind of coincided with the end of the popularity for the Carpenters. They still had a hit or two.
Mm-hmm.
John Denver, hits stopped coming. In 1975, he was so popular with Thank God I'm a Country Boy, I'm Sorry, The Flip Side, Calypso.
Yep.
You know, 76, he had Fly Away, which he did with Olivia. And then I'm sure he wanted to do hits, but for some reason, they stopped coming too, and it was all in the mid to late 70s.
Yeah, like you said, the pop charts changed, definitely. Definitely changed from what had been before. It's new stuff. Some of it was the punk new wave groups, but also disco.
Some of it was Barry Manilow. Yeah,
absolutely.
Look at how popular he was starting in 1975, coinciding with the demise of Three Dog Night.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
So they have had many reunion concerts. I've never seen them in any of their concert tours over the years. They've had a lot of personnel changes throughout the years. But Danny Hutton still tours with the band, along with Michael Alsop. Now, Corey Wells died in 2015, Joe Shermy in 2002. Chuck Negron, now in his 80s, no longer tours. But I kind of wish I'd seen them. We saw, I'm sure, at one time or another, at Blossom or Public Hall or something. Some of these reunion concerts, the Buckinghams, the Grassroots.
Yeah, the Happy Together tours, yeah. Things like that. And I know they were on some of those. And, you know, sometimes your tastes get in your way almost. I don't want to see them. But, you know, when you go back and you remember how good they were, just to listen to an hour of their music would have been fun.
I remember, if you listen to the songs that I just rattled off, there's more than a dozen. You put those together on a little compilation CD, and you'll be talking about Happy Together. You'll have a smile on your face from now until an hour from now.
Oh, absolutely.
All those tunes are great, great songs, and they're not all schmaltzy or something, or not all the same vein. They're different kinds of songs.
No, some of them are real rock and roll songs, too.
I remember, as I said, I didn't buy a lot of albums as a kid. When I was 12 years old, my brother Bob took me out and said, you can get any album you want. And I chose Harmony by Three Dog Night. It had
really?
An old-fashioned love song on it. And I was just so happy to have an album. But you know how many times I've listened to the whole thing? Not many.
No,
I still picked out the singles, the songs from it. It wasn't a greatest hits package. And so I wondered why I did that. But I'm kind of glad I did pick out that album, and I still have it to this day in my collection.
Oh, that's neat.
Harmony by Three Dog Night. And so they're one of my favorite bands. We'll probably talk about other groups like that too, like Bad Company and Guess Who, and following them, Bachman Turner Overdrive. And
sure.
A lot of other bands that kind of came and then went, and sometimes went quickly, didn't they?
Definitely.
Next time around, we'll be talking about the Talking Heads, who had a nice little run there, a little 10-year run, kind of like the Cars. That'll be our topic of conversation, our featured artist. Next time, for Frank Ost. Thanks for being here, Frank.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome back. This is Tim Friedman. We'll see you next week.